Today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to all the men and women who have served and are currently on station with the Canadian military.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
Yeah, and hello out there to all of our listening audience. Right here listening to Veterans Radio. It's Bob Gould with another program coming to you live from WDEO 990 AM, our flagship station, part of the Ave Maria Network. Right here in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it is a beautiful day today. And with me today is my partner, 195th Assault Helicopter. I'll tell you, folks, I saw him with a helicopter last weekend. It was great. This guy really knows his stuff. You know, I haven't really had a chance of talking about choppers, and he knew everything. And here he is, my partner, Dale. Dale, welcome.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Well, fine, especially after watching you. You had a grin from ear to ear when you were standing next to that Huey.
I'll tell you, Bob, it was almost like a 69 Pontiac Le Mans, you know, the car, and I felt like I was cleaning it up for my first date.
Well, it like so many of those memorial, they kind of get relic-y. They got a little beat up, so I was watching you stand next to it, and the pride that you had. What was the number that was built on that chopper? Was that 200 or
that particular helicopter was number 275?
275, right?
Right, and it turns out what we're talking about, folks, is that there's a static display of a Huey down at the VFW and the VVA council grounds in Ann Arbor, down on Wagner Road, and we're in the process of trying to restore our particular helicopter. But it turns out that helicopter was part of the 170th Assault Helicopter Company in Vietnam, and it had crashed in 1969 and had been sent back to Corpus Christi to be rebuilt, and from there it went off to Germany and then it's kind of gone around the country, and then we have it now, and so we're going to rebuild it.
And we will keep you posted, folks.
Yeah, it's exciting. We want to keep it as an open display where people can get in and get in the seats and see how the controls work and everything. I think that'll be cool.
Way cool. Today on the program, we're going to have Mr. Tom Walsh, author of, I'm going to make sure I get that right, Remembering the Canadian Yanks. That sounds like a misnomer, Canadian Yanks. Yeah, well, we're going to find out all about that in just a minute. We have a couple of special guests. Actually, we have one on the phone right now, and I'm going to get to that one first. I'm going to get this right. Tammy Marie Koudialis, who is the director of Project Salute. Yeah, I got to get that right. At the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law, where she teaches and practices veterans law. So, anyway, Project Salute is coming up with a standout. Tammy, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you so much for having me on.
What in the world is a standout?
Well, a stand-down, the easiest way to explain it to everyone is that it's a veterans resource fair. So what we did is we looked out in the community at all of our various partners across Southeast Michigan, and we said, how about bringing your office to one location on September the 19th and holding everything open so that veterans can come in and their survivors can come in and get all the help that they need in one spot.
Now, where's this going to be again? Is it going to be on the campus?
That's going to be on the campus of Macomb Community College at the Macomb Sports and Expo Center, and that's in Warren.
Yeah.
On September the 19th.
Do you happen to know what mile road that's near?
I do. Okay. I do. I have their address for you.
That'll help.
There you go. 14500 East 12 Mile Road,
okay.
And that's in Building P.
Building?
P as in Peter.
Oh, okay.
In Warren.
Okay.
And it's from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. It's 12 Mile and Hayes.
Okay, so what should they bring with them? This is a chance, folks, for you to have to have your law questions answered. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. There's way beyond the law as well. The Department of Veterans Affairs is one of my partners, so all of their various different groups are going to be on site, including the VA regional office in Detroit. We have health care providers that are going to be there. We have social service providers like Care of Southeastern Michigan and Narcotics Anonymous and United Way. We have a lot of housing assistance available right on site. We have service organizations on site if you have questions for them. We have employment agencies that are going to participate. And we have educational facilities, universities, and colleges that will be there with their representatives, as well as a whole host of legal service providers.
So once,
legal aid.
So once again, folks, this is called Project Salute, S-A-L-U-T-E, Project Salute. And it's all about helping you with your disability claims, your pension benefits, et cetera, et cetera. Am I right, Tammy?
That is correct. That is our focus of our program. Absolutely.
Now,
we are free.
Now, that was another question. Sure. Okay. Now, it's 3 hours. Are you going to be able to accommodate people?
Well, it's from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, okay. It's from 9 to 2, so yes. Yep, we hope to be able to accommodate everybody right there on site that needs to, you know, get advice, information, assistance, whatever it is that they need on that day. And we are available beyond that as well, as all of these providers are.
Well, folks, this is your opportunity, and you don't necessarily have to go to a private attorney when you have the help of folks at Project Salute, that they will be at the, what's the name of the building again? What's the name of the complex?
It's the Macomb Sports and Expo Center.
Macomb
Sports.
And it's Sports.
Building P.
Yeah, okay.
In Warren.
Okay, in Warren, 14500 East 12 Mile, right? I got that down.
That's right.
Cool. Would you please come back on the program again, Tammy, and we can go more in detail on this,
Absolutely. I'd be happy to.
And we want to thank you very much for being up at a very, very early time. Where am I calling? Oh, I'm calling Detroit anyway, right? Okay, so you're...
You are.
Right, so this is not like you're down there in Mexico or...
Not at all.
Thank you very much from all of us
well,
veterans for doing what you do. It's so important. There is, so often we hear in Veterans Radio, tell us where we can go and get this info. Because there is the government and the VA, your VA healthcare system, the VA system itself provides. There's so much out there. And we can only provide just a little smattering of it, folks. So once again, Tammy, thank you very much. And a salute to you folks that are part
thank
of
you.
Project Salute. God bless.
Thank you so much. Take
okay.
Care.
Whew, boy, that's a lot. Wow, that's a lot to do. Really, get some help on that. And now, in the studio with me, let me tell you, give you a little bit of a background, folks. A few weeks back, I was at Thunder Over Michigan, which is the Yankee Air Museum air show. And I always like to wander around because I just love air shows. I like anything military. Deja vu all over again, right? Yeah, I'm sure a lot of you guys are shaking, and women are shaking your head too. Well, anyway, I was out there, and I have a special affinity for the reenactors. Way cool to be a reenactor. And something caught my eye. It happened to be the 101st Airborne Patch. Okay, that little bit of a crowd noise there on that one, 101st Airborne all the way, and a medical stripe. And it drew me to this gentleman who's sitting right across me right now in the studio, Mr. Dylan Becker. Did I get that right? We got to kind of boost this guy up a little bit. It's early in the morning for a 12-year-old, folk. Yeah. And he was completely decked out in World War II, 101st Airborne, paratrooper, and medic. Now, why was that an affinity to me? Because I was 101st Airborne, paratrooper, medic with the 326 Medical Battalion. So I immediately, of course, struck up a conversation. Now, these are people that billet. They were bivouacked out there, folks, okay? I mean, they walked the talk. They lived the life right down to, I was looking at Dylan this morning, and he's got it right down to the And Dylan, by the way, is accompanied by his grandfather, Kim. Kim, yeah. Welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Okay, let's get you a little closer to the mic. There you go. And Dylan, how did all this come about that you became a reenactor?
Well, I did some searching on my history, and I'm German, so I looked at the Holocaust, and then I went deeper. I went to the Detroit Museum of the Holocaust, and I went deeper to the concentration camps that were liberated by the U.S., and then I watched, like, Band of Brothers and all that, and I liked the 101st.
Whoa, why is that?
Well, because they're...
Great patch, right?
Yeah, they're awesome, and I always got... My parents took me to World War II reenactments or different timeline reenactments, and I started off with River Time. I did a Vietnam impression from the 101st, and then I got some more money, and I put together a paratrooper impression with some money I had, and I got my grandpa into it, and he said yes, because really my dad didn't really want to, but... So then we went to Frankenmuth, the Heritage and Heroics Festival.
That's Frankenmuth, Michigan.
Yeah, Frankenmuth, Michigan. And we met Mila, the Michigan Living Historical and Actors Society, and they hooked us up, and they kind of gave us the gear we needed. They helped us out. They made us not FARB. It's kind of like not right.
Now, Dylan, who does this with you?
My grandpa.
Oh, do you hear that, folks? All you grandfathers and fathers and stepfathers and uncles and what? You can get involved with these kids. Can you imagine this kid's 12 years old? I think it's great. You really keep going. Tell us more. So you're doing all this research. And how old were you when you started this?
Well, I was about 10. I was about 10 years old when I started Vietnam. And then I turned about between 10 and 11 that summer. I did World War II. And I started paratrooper reenacting 101st. And I went to River Time in Bay City, Michigan. And I've been going to that. This is my third year coming up this September 27th through the 29th. We're having it. And so after that, I got more money together, and I bought like a full paratrooper kit. And then I did a parade with the veterans, and I met a lot of veterans.
Well, you're doing all this. What do you like the most?
Well, I like meeting the veterans a lot and hearing the stories and teaching people about it, and for they won't forget, and honoring them, for they won't be forgotten.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I know that, well, Kim, when you got yourself involved with your grandson, was this something that you had thought about before, or did it just come as a complete surprise?
No, Dylan came up to me and said, Papa, I need somebody to go out and reenact with me. He said, my dad doesn't want to do it, and his mother's boyfriend really didn't have the interest for it. So I said, well, I'll reluctantly get involved with Dylan's reenacting activity. And we started off the first year we spent sleeping in a pup tent, which was quite different
pup
for me.
Pup tent.
Yeah.
That's the last time you heard that one, Dale, pup tent.
Yeah.
Long time ago.
Anyway, we slept in the pup tent, and I said, no, we've got to move up here. So he saved up money for canvas, and we went up to an officer's tent, which is an 8x10, which you could fit two cots in, and we slept in that. Was quite a move up from the smaller tent.
So what is it that you like the most about this? And I mean, obviously involvement with your grandson, but what does it do for you and the closeness that you've developed with Dylan?
Well, it's the education more than anything else, I think, and the camaraderie that we have not only with my grandson, but also with fellow reenactors. When we went to Frankenmuth, we met up with a Third ID, and they really helped us out. They gave Dylan a lot of equipment, especially medical equipment, seeing he is a medic. He would like to carry a weapon out on the reenacting field, but he's not quite old enough to do that.
Okay,
But he can be a medic because supposedly they don't carry the weapons anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And he really enjoyed that first year, especially in Frankenmuth when we had two reenactments that we did there.
Dylan, what sticks out in your mind of the most exciting moment that you had when you were doing reenacting?
Well, probably our first reenactment, because that was the most, like at Frankenmuth, we didn't really have a lot of the gear, but it was really... Everything you saw there was really just amazing. It was like just the history and everything, and It was wow.
And
was
what crazy. Does what does the future hold now? We've got about a minute. What does the future hold for you as far as reenacting and
probably I want to keep reenacting and keep it in my family and probably just get more gear and move on and read more stories and tell and teach kids.
Do your buddies come with you on some of these little things?
Not really, but I've met different kids. There's other kids who reenact, mm-hmm. and I've met them, and now they're my friends, and there's a lot of,
when's your
lot
next,
of good stuff.
When's your next gig?
River of Time in Bay City, Michigan. It's September 27th through the 29th, and it's basically Saturday and Sunday, but at 7:30 on Friday night, we have a POW meeting for veterans, and they honor the veterans who died.
If you had a moment here, which I'm going to give you, to say whatever you want to say to all the veterans, what would you say?
Thank you for serving, and I'm happy to keep your memory alive, and I really thank you for serving. You keep our country good.
Kim?
I'd say the same thing. I said I'm really proud of not only what we're doing, but also for the veterans. We have the veterans coming up, and they tell me with tears in their eyes a lot of times that they're really proud that we are promoting them, keeping their memories alive as well.
Dylan, your teacher had a baby. You want to say a little congrats to that?
Congratulations, Miss Brandau, on your baby. I hope she's good, and I can't wait to.
And something to your principal.
Thank you, Mrs. Long, and keep on being a good principal.
Oh, good. Better than a bad principal. And you had two other names.
I have a shout out to Mallory and Chris.
Mallory and Chris. Okay, Mallory and Chris. Thank you very much, both. Kim and Dylan, for being on the program. You may want to stay here for the first part of our interview with Tom Walsh. Okay,
good.
So please, and do come back again to Veterans Radio.
Okay.
Well, we'll be right back right after this message, so don't go away.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
host all of that. that's a radio, and that's live radio, folks. But Canada, the true north, strong and free. Wow, what an introduction. I got to introduce my guest today, Mr. Tom Walsh, author. Tom, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you, Bob, and that was quite an introduction. I was kind of standing here at attention for a few seconds.
Well, we're very proud right here at Veterans. In fact, I think this is the first. Dale, have we had any other Canadian-themed programs?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. This would be the first time. We also had an edition in French, but we couldn't understand it, so we decided we probably shouldn't play that one.
Well, our neighbors...
I wouldn't be able to understand that either.
Our neighbors to the north, which have always been supportive of the Americans and the American military. But Mr. Tom Walsh has been a student of aviation history all of his adult life, writing for over 30 years. He worked as a producer and consultant of the North American air show industry. He's now retired. Spends his time researching and writing historical World War II aviation books and articles. Boy, is that a fair assessment, Tom?
Pretty good, but
pretty good.
You know, I'm certainly not an expert at it. I'm more of a novice, and I have problems with people saying that I'm a writer. I like to think of myself as a biographer, you know, kind of like a detective who gathers in all the facts and then puts it in a written story form.
Well, I have the book right here in front of me, folks. And as we say from time to time, we do review these books. And with the holidays coming up, we get emails and questions that, gee, what do I buy the veteran? Well, this is what you can buy the veteran, because it gives and keeps on giving. It is the title, Remember the Canadian Yanks, Tom Walsh. And let me give you just a very, very quick background. There it was, September 1. Boy, how timely. 1939. Somebody do the math on that, whatever. But where Germany attacked Poland, and that became the beginning, truly, of World War II. At that time, within 2 weeks, the Canadian government declared war on Germany, and then it all began. Why don't you take us from that point, Tom?
Well, basically, Canada, of course, was a Commonwealth nation, part of the Commonwealth nation to the United Kingdom. And when Germany did start her rampage across Europe, Australia and New Zealand and Britain and Canada were the first four Commonwealth countries to declare war against Germany. But Canada at the time had an almost paltry air force, in that she only had about 4,000 people in uniform and probably a couple of hundred planes. And she realized at the time that probably the single biggest contribution she could make to the war effort would be as a training ground, a safe training ground away from the fighting in Europe, where they could take the time to, you know, train the thousands of airmen that were going to be needed to, you know, prosecute the war. They had no idea the war was going to run, you know, until May 1945, almost 6 years. But that's basically, how Canada got involved. Now, one half, by the way, of the 4,000 people that were in her Air Force in 1939 were reservists. So that kind of gives you an idea that, it was a very small and at the time a very ineffective force. So in December 1939, Britain and Canada and New Zealand and Australia got together and signed what came into being as the British Commonwealth Air Training Program, the BCATP, and they basically built about 100 new air stations or air bases in Canada, and then modified an existing 25 or 30 more, and then the training began, the recruitment began, and of course they just didn't have enough bodies to, you know, fill all these schools, and so away she went from there, type of thing.
Well, and folks, by the way, if you have any questions for our guest Tom Walsh, please call us at 877-573-7825, 877-573-7825, right? Okay. Now, here we had these barnstormers, these guys that were crop dusters and barnstormers and young pilots and hotshots and over in America. And they had a chance to go and fight the Hun. And they right. came across the border. Why don't you take it from there, Tom?
Well, basically, in the America, the United States, rather, didn't get into the war until December 8th, 1941, the day after Pearl Harbor. So basically, they didn't want any of their people fighting in a foreign war, either going to Britain or going to Canada or wherever, because that would violate the Neutrality Act. And America was trying to stay out of the war, trying to remain neutral. I think the president at the time, you know, wanted to get into it, wanted to help Britain and Poland, etc. But the Congress was pretty much in a state of isolation at the time and said, no, this is a European issue and we're going to stay out of it. Simply because, you know, she had just come out of World War I 20 years earlier and had lost a lot of personnel in that conflict. And here was Germany back again after 20 years, you know, starting up all over again. So there just wasn't the will or the stomach, if you will, to start this this thing up again. And, of course, you know, America had just come out of the recession and the Dirty 30s, as they called it, and unemployment was terribly high. 11 million people, I think, at the time in the United States were out of work. So, at any rate, the recruiting to get into the pre-war Army Air Corps or the Navy, you had to have 2 years of college.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
You couldn't be any younger than 21. You couldn't be any older than 25. And you had to be single. So that was a finite window, you know, that people had to fit into just to qualify to get into the Air Corps.
Now, remember, folks, this is pre-war stuff, so we didn't have the crisis. This is before Pearl Harbor, and it also was a big peace movement in the United States at that time. Folks were questioning why Mr. Roosevelt would, President Roosevelt would want to get involved, and it was more isolationist. So there were a number of these pilots, isn't that right, Tom, that went, hey, I'm not going to be able to do anything here, I'm going to go to Canada. How many of those that did that?
Well, I was just going to say, Bob, that there were so few billets in the Army Air Corps and in the Navy flying jobs at the time that they were cherry picking who they would take. So even though you had the 2 years minimum college, that didn't mean you were going to get in, because most of the people they were taking had full degrees, so they could cherry pick who they wanted. Well, this left a lot of people out of the system, and the fall of 1940, the U.S. government announced that they were going to start up conscription for 1 million personnel between 1940 and 1941, and this was meant that a lot of people who didn't qualify for a flying job were going to be conscripted into the Army. Well, as you say, there were a lot of pilots. People that were crop dusters and air show performers and instructors, etc., who had a lot of hours, and they thought, well, I really don't want to fight my war from a muddy foxhole. I want to do it in the air. Because at the time, there were newsreel clips that were coming across the ocean from Europe highlighting the Royal Air Force, in their fight, flying Spitfires and Hurricanes. And, of course, they were the glamour boys of the RAF, and they were shown in every movie theater on a newsreel clip every week or every day. And these were young guys flying around in high-performance fighters, except so a lot of the Americans who didn't qualify came to Canada in 1939, some mostly in 40, 41, And at the end of the war, over 9,000 Americans had served part or all of their training or their service in the Royal Canadian Air Force. And that's an astounding number of personnel.
Okay, folks, we've got about 20 seconds before the halfway point, and we've got a break coming up. Tom, I want you to stay with us, and we will continue our interviewing of Tom Walsh, our guest today, author of Remember the Canadian Yanks, all about Americans going over to the RCAF and becoming pilots. We're going to be right back, so don't go away. You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on WDEO.
You're listening to Veterans Ratio. Radio on WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, WMAX 1440 AM in Saginaw, WDEO 98.5 FM in Naples, and online at AveMariaRadio.net.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. It was Staff Sergeant Henry Irwin's job on the lead B-29 to drop a phosphorus canister as a marker when they reached the assembly area over enemy territory. Details after this.
Why are you so distant?
Did you have to shoot anyone?
You gonna get a job now or what?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org, brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Irwin positioned the canister in the launch tube and pulled the pin at the pilot's orders. The flare dropped and then flew back into the plane. It exploded in Irwin's face, spewing flames just feet away from tons of incendiary bombs. Smoke filled the aircraft momentarily, blinding the pilot and co-pilot and putting the plane in a steep dive. Irwin dropped to his knees and, unable to see, felt for the canister. Although it was burning at 1,300 degrees, he picked it up, cradled it to his body, and began crawling to the cockpit. He yelled to the co-pilot to open the window and threw the flare out. The crew then turned its fire extinguisher on him and began to feed plasma into his arm. Doctors were sure he was going to die and transferred him to Guam. Major General Curtis LeMay recommended him for the Medal of Honor and got authorities to expedite the award so it could be presented before he died. 1 week after the attack, LeMay presented the medal to Irwin at a bedside ceremony attended by the rest of his crew and his brother. Irwin surprised doctors by surviving. He was flown home to Alabama, where he was hospitalized for 2.5 years and underwent numerous operations. Henry Irwin died on January 16, 2002. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
For the past 100 years, Amish furniture craftsmen have placed great value upon the beauty and quality of their work, with great attention paid to the details of the wood. Each board is then hand-selected to match the specific furniture in mind and in achieving the desired look of the finished piece. At Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor Showroom, you will find displays of this fine craftsmanship that you can afford and own. Now is the time. You can visit Naked Furniture at 3570 Washtenaw Avenue and experience this fine quality for yourself. The furniture consultants at Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor are there to show you the fine details of Amish furniture. See for yourself the fine quality Amish furniture. Go to Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor, 3570 Washtenaw Avenue, or visit their website, nakedfurnitureofannarbor.com.
Coming in on a wing and a prayer.
Yeah, something from World War II. Coming in on a wing and a prayer, a little salute to all the pilots, the fighter pilots, the bomber pilots, the hump pilots, all the pilots. And with me as our guest today on Veterans Radio, Mr. Tom Walsh. And he's a historian, and I got to say this, he did write the book, so I guess he's an author, Remembering the Canadian Yanks. Tom, how can they get the book?
Well, the book's available, Bob, through Amazon.com or Borders.com. and here in Canada at Amazon.ca.
Okay, Amazon.com, right all this time. Now, there's something here that you and I talked about last week, that one of the problems that when these guys join the RCAA, that they had to say a pledge allegiance to the Canadian government. Why don't we just explain that a little bit?
No, they really didn't. I'm not sure where that all started, but my research has indicated that that's not true. If they had have pledged allegiance to, the constitutional head of Canada at the time, King George VI of England, they would have lost their U.S. citizenship. So the RCAF conveniently got around that by asking them to obey their superior officers and Air Force regulations. So they never lost their citizenship at any time during their service. And I might say that the RCAF, they had lower restrictions or lower entrance qualifications. And we were taking them in the during the war at as young as age 17, as old as age 42, single, married, didn't matter, and grade 12 education was suffice. A couple of them they took with a grade 11 education, and they just said, if you can do it, you know, they convinced them that they could do it, and they said, if you can do it, go ahead, and they got through the system.
Now, How long did it take you to do the research for this book?
Probably about 5 to 6 years, and you know it's ongoing. It really never stops. Book number two, which will have 30 biographies in it, and probably a few more pictures than the first book, because it had 35 biographies. It'll be ready to go probably over the winter months sometime.
So you have other volumes that you're getting that you're preparing for?
Oh yes, I have enough work on my credenza right now for books 3 and 4, and
that's exciting.
5 and 6 possibly in the next 7 to 8 years. I might add that like the 9,000 Americans that did serve part or all of their careers, the U.S. government knew exactly where they were at all times. And because when they left the United States and then entered the RCAF, they had to register with their local draft boards. And so the government knew where they were, and they knew what they were doing, and that was fine because we were fighting the same enemy for the exact same reasons.
Well, and some of these guys after Pearl Harbor wanted to go into the American Air Force, and they wanted to fight for the U.S., and some did, and they really got, they got a reception, not officially. Why don't you talk about that a little bit, Tom?
Well, some of them did go back, and out of the 9,000, I think that almost 4,000 transferred, laterally transferred from the RCAF back to an American military service of their choosing, usually the Air Corps, but some became Navy flyers, some Marine Corps flyers. Some of the early ones that went back, they didn't quite know what to do with them. They had not achieved officer status in the RCAF. They were what they call sergeant pilots, and they had that same category in the RAF. So when they transferred back, first of all, they had to create a separate rank in the Army Air Corps, which was called flight officer. It was equivalent to a warrant officer in the Army. And it was only used in World War II. So, when they went back, they fought under the American flag. And of course, Americans are great patriots, and that was one of the reasons that they wanted to go back. B, if they were a sergeant pilot, they immediately entered the officer's commission world, as we say. Their pay went up 2.5 times over what they were making in the Royal Canadian Air Force.
Well, that's always good.
And the fourth thing was they had a $10,000 insurance package policy on every American service personnel in World War II. The Royal Canadian Air Force and the Royal Air Force did not have that kind of coverage. Hence the term, when you've probably heard this many times, somebody bought the farm referencing the fact that they died. Yeah. Well, that came directly from World War II. It came out of the air element side, and in most cases, that $10,000 was enough to pay off the mortgage on the family farm.
And that, were they still able to fly fighters, or were some of them relegated to more milk run sort of?
Most of them, because of their training and their operational experience, they were welcomed back. In most cases, saying, "Well, you're trained. You can help us. You've been there. You've done a tour of duty. We haven't even gone across the pond yet." So, but some of them were, some of the old school officers were saying, "Look, we really don't want to take you. You didn't go to college. We think that you're an undisciplined lot, but we have to accept you." And some of them, received lousy assignments, instructors, and that sort of thing, which they didn't want because they had just come off a tour flying Spitfires or Hurricanes. And but the majority of cases, they assimilated back into their regular service in the United States. And a lot of them rose to very high rank. There were several, like when they went back into the Army Air Corps, by the way, they were entitled to wear their RCAF wings over their left breast pocket, and they wore their Army wings, or their Air Corps wings, over their right breast pocket. I'm sorry, left breast pocket for the Army Air Corps, right breast pocket for the RCAF wings. So they would be walking around sporting two sets of wings on their tunics. And, of course, at dances, this alienated some of the other American pilots because, they're wearing one set of wings, the other guys are wearing two, and, of course, the ladies at the dances just assumed that the guys wearing two sets of wings were superior airmen. And of course, the cagey pilots wearing two sets of wings would say nothing,
That's very interesting. As I see my partner Dale here shaking his head. Dale, and he's putting the thumbs up. What do you got to comment on that about wearing two sets of wings?
I don't think it's two sets of wings. You got to remember that these guys are 19 to 22, 23 years old. There's a little testosterone level, increasing here, and, I'm bigger and better than you are and so forth. And,
amen.
More
that's
wings
right.
Meant the opportunity possibly of meeting somebody. So, I can understand
That's exactly right. But, some of these fellows rose to three-star general rank in the United States Army Air Force.
Can you name anybody?
Yes, there was
anybody that we would know?
Pete Peterson, who was the first commander of the 4th Fighter Wing, U.S. Army Air Corps 1st Fighter Wing, rose to 3-star general rank. There was another one, a 2-star, Major McCollum. But anyway, I got sidetracked for a second. Up until the mid-1960s, there were still two or three generals walking around the Pentagon sporting two sets of wings. And a couple of times during their
and a
careers,
hockey puck in their pocket, probably. They still got the Canadian. No!
I'm not sure about that. But a couple of times in their careers, they were approached by other Air Force officers, and they said, "Don't you think it's time that you remove those?" Referencing the RCAF wings, and they said, "No, we earned those wings, and we earned the right to wear them, and they'll never come off our
Amen. Wings." Dale's shaking his head right now.
Oh, well, we always have. pilots have that.
It's a fascinating, untold piece of history that I'm just having a ball, excavating all this information and putting it together, because a lot of them, never received the glory that they should have, and a lot of them did become aces, but some of them didn't. They had one or two kills, and then they were shot down themselves and died in action. And, you know, but when you're dead in combat, it doesn't matter how you died. The fact is you gave your life for the cause, and those people should never be forgotten.
Amen to that. We're coming up on our third break in just a moment. Tom, stay with us. We'll be right back with Tom Walsh, author of Remember the Canadian Yanks, the story of American pilots, bomber pilots, and fighter pilots fighting for the RCAF, Royal Canadian Air Force. We'll be right back in just a minute. Tom, think about one. I know you've got so many stories. Think about one story that you'd like to tell our listeners about. We'll be right back. You listen to Veterans Radio right here on 990 AM.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Yeah, I thought I'd give you a little bit of the Andrews Sisters. It actually is rum and coke. No, this was Cherry Tree, right? Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree. No, this is rum and coke. No, this was Apple Tree. Okay. Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree with anybody else but me. You understand? Okay. And with us right now, back for the last segment of our program today, is Mr. Tom Walsh, author and historian. His book, Remember the Canadian Yanks, is now out on hardcover. Is it in paperback, Tom?
It's not in paperback or e-book form as yet. I'm actually looking for a new publisher, because I want to make improvements to Volume 1, and my current publisher is resisting that. I think it's a cost issue, so I'm trying to go with someone else who will appreciate the work and, you know, who will do the next four or five volumes as well.
Well, maybe we can help you out with that. It seems like we're finally getting on the list of all these different publishers, and they're sending us books, so maybe we can hook you up with somebody.
Sure.
That'd be more than happy to help you out.
Oh, that'll be too easy, guys. Thank you.
Well, now let's get back to our story. Here we are, and book one, volume one, Remember the Canadian Yanks. You have approximately, what, 33 stories, 35 stories? Pick one.
35, yeah.
Pick one and tell us about that.
Well, probably the chapter one deals with John Kerry Red Morgan, who was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. Morgan was a roustabout kind of a guy, big guy, red-headed fellow, 6'2", well over 200 pounds, and he went to various colleges and universities in the States. He kept getting kicked out. He went over to the Fiji Islands. His father was an attorney for Texaco Oil, and his father finally got fed up with paying all the various tuitions, and part of the tuition money he was spending on flying lessons instead of paying for his education. But anyway, he sent him over to the Fiji Islands, and he came back in 1940, and he wanted to join the Air Corps. And he had 1 year of college, and the Air Corps said, no, you have a poor academic record. We're not interested. So he went to work for Texaco in their oil fields in Oklahoma. And on a drilling rig, a 55-gallon oil drum broke loose, and Red Morgan tried to grab it to stop its momentum. But anyway, he broke his neck in that encounter, and the Army classified him as 4F. Well, he came to Canada and in 1941, and he enlisted in the RCAF. And someone said to him, well, if you were classified as 4F in the Air Corps, how could you possibly be, enlisting in the RCAF? And he said, they never asked me if I broke my neck, and I never told them. But anyway, he managed to pass a physical. I don't know how he did that. But he got his wings here in Canada as a sergeant pilot, went overseas, trained at the operational training unit with an RAF unit, was flying some twin-engine bombers in England. And when the call went out basically in May 1942 for, those Americans who had either been trained in the RCAF or the RAF, to come back, John Kerry answered that call appointed a flight officer, and he was a co-pilot on a B-17 on a mission. He had taken off, and they were over Holland, and they were attacked by FW-190s. Excuse me. A cannon, a 20-millimeter cannon shell, came down through the top of the B-17 and hit the fragments of that shell, hit the pilot by the name of Campbell in the back of the head. And it also severed the arm of the top turret gunner in that one firing pass. Campbell, the pilot, slumped over the controls, unconscious. Morgan was the co-pilot. Put the plane into a dive. Morgan had to pull back, get Campbell back in the seat to stay in formation. And so for 2 hours...
Did you hear that, folks? Stay in formation.
Stay in formation.
Did his job.
His crew was to stay in formation as opposed to turning around, heading back across the channel, with a seriously injured pilot and a top turret gunner with his arm severed cleanly at the shoulder. With regard to the top turret gunner, they figured he only had one chance to survive, and that was to parachute him out of the plane and hope the Germans found him in time before he bled to death. That's what they did, and they did find him. They took him to a hospital, and he became a prisoner of war, and he did live to, survive and tell the tale later. So for 2 hours, the pilot kept going in and out of consciousness, and each time he would sort of come to, he was fighting Red Morgan for control of the aircraft, and he was punching Morgan, and for 2 hours, Morgan's flying the B-17 in formation with one hand and trying to hold off the crazed, wounded pilot with the other. And in that initial firing pass, most of the communications and the oxygen supply had been cut off to the other parts of the crew in the B-17, so nobody else knew what was going on up in the cockpit. Finally, the navigator came up just to have a look around because they were coming up to the IP, and then Morgan, who's in the right seat, said, "I can't land this thing from the right seat. I got to get over to the left seat." So between the two of them, it took them about 20 minutes. They got Campbell down into the navigator compartment, and Morgan then flew the bomber for the rest of the mission, dropped the bombs, came back. The bomber's name was Ruthie 2, I think, and landed. And the interesting part of the story, he wasn't supposed to fly the mission as the co-pilot. He had been put in hack before the mission for some violation of an Air Force regulation. He snuck out of his barracks. He went to the briefing. Then he goes out to the plane on the flight line and convinces the replacement co-pilot that he is now flying the mission, and the other guys want it back at headquarters, and they're going to reassign him. By the time it all got straightened out, the plane had taken off, and Morgan basically was in a lot of trouble. So when he got back, they put him in hack again for disobeying the original order. He never told anybody anything about the harrowing experience or the mission that he had flown. Well, anyway, the rumors started to float around the airbase about what he had done, and when the brass heard about it, they investigated and they found out, wow, we can't not, you know, honor this guy, but we can't use the date of the mission because the records indicate that he was confined to barracks. So they changed the mission date from, I think, the 26th to the 28th, and they put in for the Congressional Medal of Honor, and he was awarded the nation's highest honor for bravery.
It doesn't sound...
Oh, what a story.
It's
something that would come out of a Hollywood scriptwriter's mind, right? But, I mean, it's a true story. So then General Eaker, who was in charge of the Youth Air Force at the time, he told Morgan not to fly any more missions. And Morgan's attitude was, well, if the war isn't over for the Allies, it's not over for me. So he transferred to another unit, and he was the pilot on another B-17 mission about a year later, and that airplane was blown out of the sky by German flak. Only three of, I think, 11 on board survived the initial explosion. Morgan was one of the three, and he had his parachute tucked under his arm in the plane. Well, he's blown free, and now he's got to put his chute on as he's dropping. He had an awful time getting it on. He finally got it on.
Hold on a second. Tom, hold a second. Folks, this guy's falling. I mean, what is that, 22 feet per second squared? Isn't that it?
Yeah, something like that.
I mean, you're really moving, and you've got to put a parachute on. Ever seen anybody put a parachute on in a room or something, right? Let alone tumbling. And wow, tell the rest of the story. I'm sorry, but I may just have to say that.
He got it on, and he just barely got it on in time, and the chute popped, and he landed in the tree. Well, then he slid out of the chute and dropped 12 feet to the ground, and they arrested him within 10 seconds after landing in Hitler's Berlin. And he was a prisoner of war for a year, and I believe he was the only Congressional Medal of Honor awardee of World War II who became a prisoner of war. Anyway, he came back to the United States. He went to work for Texaco. He worked his whole life for Texaco. I think he died in 2004. He never flew. He kept the pilot's license after the war, but he never flew. He, you know, whenever he wanted to go up for a flight, one of his many friends would take him, and he would never talk about his own experience. He thought that it was too boring. If you can believe that.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. You know, Dale, you've commented often on the, I guess the word is modesty, that that these folks have.
Right, you're just doing your job.
Display, that's right. Yeah, I was doing my job.
Just doing your job. This guy sounds fascinating. I got to read this book before they're all gone. story about this guy, because I'm reading as you guys are talking, and it shows that he actually did... He tried to get back into the Air Force during the Korean War, and they wouldn't let him.
No.
Well, yeah, he wanted to fly combat, and they said, no, you're not flying combat. So they did, in fact, let him fly transports just within the continental United States. But, he was quite a character.
Well, I can hear the music in the background. So would you believe our time is up? Tom, we'd like to welcome you back. Talk about when you get into volume two, I can say that too. And your book, Remember the Canadian Yanks, you can get it at Amazon.com. Where else?
Borders.com or in Canada at Amazon.ca. If anyone is unsure, just Google Remembering the Canadian Yanks and a whole bunch of different websites.
And thank you again, Tom. Thank you. Thank you for being on Veterans Radio. Wow. Wow. I mean, that was exciting. I read that first chapter,
sure.
I had just one light on, and it was really dark outside. It was really cool. Well, we're wrapping up another episode of Veterans Radio Program. Next week, your host will be Dale Throneberry. We've got 7, 6, 5, Dale, and Nina, and Maria, and all of our guests. Have a good day.
Oh.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.